Welcome to Dig Deep, a podcast that explores the world of drilling and environmental remediation. Join us as our hosts and technical experts dig into industry news, technologies, safety, and sustainability. This show is brought to you by Cascade Environmental, a company that offers a full range of geotechnical and environmental drilling, advanced site investigation, and highly innovative remediation services and technologies. Have feedback or something specific you want to hear? Email communications@cascade-env.com or click the link in the episode notes. We greatly appreciate feedback to help make this podcast a valuable resource for you.
Hey, this is Sue Bruning.
And I'm Rob Dankert.
And we're thrilled you're joining us for our very first Dig Deep podcast. In each episode, we'll focus on one aspect of the environmental industry by interviewing experts, talking about hot topics of the day, offer a few safety tips, and hey, whatever else tickles our fancy.
Today we chose emerging contaminants, and in particular PFAS, to start things off. We'll be discussing the challenges with characterizing and remediating these contaminants, in addition to how it has impacted areas in the United States where PFAS has been in the news.
We'll also interview Seth Pitkin, National Director of Site Characterization Services here at Cascade, along with Mike Rossi, Director of Analytical Chemistry Services. These guys have been dealing with emerging contaminants for over two decades. Lastly, we'll take an audio tour through Cascade's new PFAS mobile lab, now available for on-site analytical at PFAS projects. So here at Cascade, safety really is our first priority, and whether it's an office meeting or the first meeting to start off a project out in the field, we always begin with a safety tip. Our podcast will be no exception. So I'm going to turn it over to Rob for today's safety tip.
Thanks, Sue. A lot of you folks may be driving right now, and as a matter of fact, if you're driving, please don't text us with any comments that you may have.
No distracted driving.
Thanks, Sue.
So for our first podcast, we chose the topic of emerging contaminants. Rob, what are emerging contaminants?
Yeah, so emerging contaminants are an ever-expanding list of contaminants or biological organisms that really haven't been historically monitored in the environment. They're often believed and sometimes scientifically proven to have adverse effects on the environment or people. So sometimes these contaminants can include pharmaceuticals or even personal care products in addition to synthetic chemicals such as per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances.
Yeah, that's kind of hard to say. I prefer PFAS.
Okay, we'll keep it easy. We'll keep it easy.
And they go by a lot of other names, as I've been reading in different articles and seeing in the media.
Yeah, they certainly do. I think some folks have called them, maybe a year ago, they called them PFCs, PFAS, and then there's some other compounds that fall within the family of PFAS.
So it looks like we've got them in cookware, most things that are water repellent. It's in food packaging. I know a big concern for my household is microwave popcorn. The healthcare, beauty, it's in makeup, it's in cosmetics. So I guess really the point is that it's everywhere, and it's popping up in the news lately.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a ton of articles out there and all sorts of news media that are publicizing the impact of PFAS in the environment and in people.
Yeah, we used to see it just in, you know, kind of science scholarly journals, maybe news from the EPA, but now it's hitting mainstream media. CNN is carrying news about it, ABC, local news channels. It's everywhere. All right, so PFAS in the news, it's not all doom and gloom, though. The CDC reports recently through their National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey that levels of PFAS in the U.S. general population in their blood levels is decreasing. And we are seeing regulations around the U.S. and around the globe to reduce or eliminate the use of these compounds. There's a lot of technology out there that help us better understand the effects they're having on human health and the environment, and also how to better detect them and remediate PFAS in the environment. Yeah, and I think it's fair to explain to our audience, a lot of times these contaminants are referred to as emerging contaminants. And that's not because they're just emerging in the environment right now, but it's more about contaminants of emerging concern. So the contaminants themselves are not just emerging in the environment, but rather our awareness of.
Have you seen any impacts, or have you seen any news periodicals with PFAS in your area?
No, you know, here in Ohio, we are close to the Great Lakes, and I haven't seen anything locally here. We do get concerned about the algae. Algal blooms, I should say. We get concerned about the algal blooms in the springtime.
Such a nuisance. Yeah, so PFOA and PFAS are the most common PFAS compounds that we hear about in the news. Each of the compounds have unique traits. So PFAS has a low vapor pressure, which means that it doesn't evaporate easily, and a low Henry's law constant means that it prefers to be in water versus in air. This rules out, or these traits rule out laboratory analysis with the GC-MS, which is the most common instrument that laboratories use these days to analyze compounds.
That's the
And the
mass
fun.
spec, right, Rob?
Yeah, exactly. So the other compound, PFOA, has a really high solubility, which means that it dissolves easily in water. So once it hits the groundwater supply, it really just takes off. Sometimes this can make finding a source area particularly difficult when you're looking at groundwater, regional groundwater issues.
And they're pretty stable, right? So they stick around. They're
Yeah,
not
absolutely.
going away.
They're very recalcitrant, so you're right, they don't break down easily. So PFOA has an extremely high solubility, so that means it dissolves really easily in water. So that can make trying to locate source areas or characterizing source areas particularly difficult because you have such dilute plumes.
And it's moving all around.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So the trick is, or conventionally, folks will install monitoring wells and collect groundwater samples and ship the samples overnight for analysis, and then you have to wait for analytical results before proceeding. But more recent advances in high-resolution site characterization have allowed more of a dynamic sampling strategy where you can do run a ton of samples in a relatively short amount of time and more quickly define the extent of a plume.
And from what I understand, you have to be looking for these chemicals very specifically, right? So, in general, groundwater testing that you've done in the past, if you weren't looking for these, you wouldn't detect them.
As I understand it, there's a specific EPA lab method and a target analyte list that you have to be looking for to locate those compounds. As I understand it, the instrumentation is relatively uncommon as well. The LC-MS/MS method is not very common. It's not as common as the GC mass spec.
So the GC-MS is the gas chromatography, but what you need for PFAS is the liquid chromatography, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. With it's called LC-MS/MS, and so the mass spec is in tandem. So I believe there's two mass spec processes that are run. Again, I am not a chemist.
But we know some really good chemists that are going to come talk to us today,
I think we do.
right? So let's bring in some experts, Rob. Who do we have today?
Well, I think Seth Pitkin and Mike Rossi are two folks that we have that have been working on these compounds for a relatively long time. How did you first meet those guys?
They came into the Cascade family with the acquisition of the Field Services Division of Stone Environmental. And I'll tell you, Rob, I was impressed with these guys from day one.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I had it's funny, when I was an intern after my time at the University of Vermont, I had sent a resume over to Stone Environmental, and this was back in 1999, and I never heard back from them. So I don't want to say I harbor any resentment from former Stone employees, but no, Seth and Mike are great. I mean, I've met those guys probably 4 or 5 years ago at various conferences, and
Yeah, and now with their work on the PFAS Mobile Lab, I think you can really consider these guys pioneers in the industry. So joining us today, we got Seth Pitkin and Mike Rossi from Cascade's office out there in Vermont. Are they actually joining us from inside the Mobile Lab?
I don't know. I don't know if they are or not. Either the mobile lab or possibly their office up in Montpelier. We now have Seth Pitkin and Mike Rossi, who have just recently dug themselves out of 2 feet of snow in Montpelier, Vermont. And Seth and Mike are going to further discuss PFAS, or our mobile lab PFAS capability. Do you want to take a minute and talk a bit about your background and what you're currently doing for Cascade?
Sure. My background is initially geology, and then about 7 years of sort of consulting in the environmental industry, and then I got a master's degree in hydrogeology from the University of Waterloo, but with a pretty strong emphasis on chemical hydrogeology. So the chemical part of it's always been pretty important to me. And I've spent about 30 years investigating mostly chlorinated solvent DNAPL type problems.
30 years?
Yeah, it's been a long while. Starting to get good at it. Then I'll retire. But anyway, so after coming back from the University of Waterloo and getting back into the consulting game, one of the first things I did was to hire Mike Rossi, who's here with me, and to help us put together a field analytical capability for us so that we could start doing adaptive investigations. Huh. And we've been doing that for, 20 years or something like that? And initially it was just gas chromatography, and then we got into GCMS, and this latest foray for PFAS is our first work with LC-MS-MS, and we're excited about bringing that to the consulting community so that they can investigate these PFAS sites in the same manner that we've been doing DNAPL sites for many years.
That's great. That's great. Mike, talk a little bit about yourself, please.
Yeah.
Don't take too long, though.
Okay. Background is chemistry, degree in chemistry undergraduate, and then I have a graduate degree in environmental engineering. Been in the industry about 25 years and primarily doing analytical chemistry and a fair amount of site investigation. Both kind of developing methodologies and tooling to assist, these high-res site characterization efforts. I think that's about it.
Okay, great. So let me back up a second. When you mentioned Elsie, it sounds like sort of like a female pet dog almost, but this would be a really Elsie. But now it's this is an expensive pet dog, I would think, right?
Right. So right. Yeah, not the same LC, really. It's liquid chromatography.
I see.
So instead of a gas phase going through the column, you've got a liquid being pushed through the column.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the mobile lab. Can you mention why Cascade is even pursuing an investment with the PFAS mobile lab?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a logical extension of what we've been doing. So Cascade Technical Services bought the field services division of Stone Environmental a little over a year ago. And that field services division focused on high resolution site characterization and dynamic work strategy. So in other words, learning from what you're doing while you're still doing it and adapting the investigation to keep it relevant and focused. And in the last several years, a set of emerging contaminants that we're referring to as PFAS have come to people's attention. And PFAS basically stands for poly and perfluorinated alkyl substances. And these things are persistent, they're mobile, and they're fairly toxic. So there's a big demand for the ability to investigate these sites and then ultimately remediate them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And our thinking was that there really isn't a good analytical technique available in the field, or there wasn't. So that was the whole point of this PFAS mobile lab, is to bring state-of-the-art analytical chemistry for these compounds to the field.
Okay. And so having the capabilities in the field, how would that benefit our client? I'm assuming you can collect a bulk volume or a larger number of samples in a short amount of time. Explain sort of the process or the dynamic process that could be applied in the field.
Sure. Yeah, so the sample collection is independent of the lab, and we have a bunch of nice techniques for doing that, including Waterloo APS and you know, high resolution soil coring and sampling and things like that. But what the on-site laboratory really allows you to do is collect those samples and get the results back either in the same day or early the next day, and assess whether or not you're in the right place with your investigation. So in other words, have you found the source zone? Do you know where the edges of it are? Do you know where the top is and the bottom is? And with PFAS also, there's, especially with the aqueous film forming foam derived PFAS, there are literally several hundred compounds present in these mixtures. And the compounds all have different physical properties, and so they behave differently in the groundwater, a lot like individuals might at an Eric Clapton concert.
Nice.
There's a lot of people doing a lot of different things. So,
nice.
You know, we want to be able to see, you know, what those different behaviors are so that we can predict fate and transport, and also how, you know, a remedy might be targeted and focused on the source area.
Okay.
Hey, Rob, mind if I jump in a little more on the technical aspect of the laboratory that we just put together? And it's pretty important to note the idea of this laboratory is the same really instrumentation and methodology as used in the fixed laboratories. And what we did a fair amount of research before launching into this, and we really did want to make sure we were doing the right thing and there was good reason for it. And what we found is that any of the methods that are available today in the field, and they're all basically screening methods, do not have the ability to get down into the part per trillion levels, nor do they have the ability to distinguish which compounds are present. They're really just sort of a gross screening tool in the PPB level, which is really about an order of magnitude off of where we need to be with this type of contaminant. So I think it's important to note that we, you know, this method is the same as that used at fixed laboratories. So the, you know, you have all the information you would have if you were using a fixed laboratory.
Hmm. Okay. So let's back up a second to what Seth mentioned in terms of large dilute plumes created as a result of the mobility of the compounds. So hypothetically, how would you approach a site? So if a client came to you open-ended and said, well, you know, I hear you guys have this tool, this is what we're looking for, how would you delineate a source area, particularly with regard to the dilute plume that's present?
Well, the way we typically do these things is to start doing transects, so a line of points of investigation oriented at right angles to the direction of groundwater flow.
Sure.
And we get a good look at the distribution of contaminants, and then that tells us both how deep they are below the water table. And in this case, actually in the source area, you'd want to go above the water table and do some soil coring and sampling there as well. Mm-hmm. But also left, right. So we do a transect, we get a nice window into the groundwater transport, and then we start moving up gradient. And once you get into the source zone, then you're going to start, like I mentioned, having to look at the interface between the vadose zone in the water table and some depth below the water table. So these compounds are going to be hung up essentially near the water table. They've got properties that cause them to want to have one end sort of sticking up into the unsaturated zone and another end into the water. And then, like I mentioned, there's a number of different compounds with a bunch of different properties. So they're going to stratify a little bit below the water table as well. So once you get into the source zone, you're probably going to want to increase the level of resolution, make it a very high resolution program.
Sure.
It'll consist of both soil and groundwater samples, which mm-hmm. this laboratory can accommodate.
So you had mentioned sampling vadose zone soils, so you obviously have capabilities to analyze other matrices other than groundwater. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep, we have the ability to run soil and groundwater analyses with this laboratory. The soil extraction is actually quite easily done. It's methanol-based, so it's a really friendly solvent, but fairly strong enough to get the material off the soil, and then it really lends itself nicely to some of the other methods that were the direct inject or the SPE method that we have as part of the analytical part of the method.
What would be the minimum detection limits that you could achieve with the lab?
Yeah, what we're seeing currently and what we've done MDLs, and they are indicating that we can see using the direct inject method between 5 and 25 parts per trillion. And using the SPE, the solid phase extraction technique, which actually involves a concentration step, we are looking at, sub part per trillion detection limits.
Mike, back to what you were talking about in terms of the additional compounds. There's 14 that are relatively common. Is that right? And
it's not so much 14 that are common. It's 14 that landed on the EPA list when they built method 537. It's really the list that I think everyone's using right now is about 24 compounds, and it's DOD, their quality system manual has indicated these 24 compounds. So that's what everyone I think is shooting for right now.
Can you complete that list? Can you do the 24 compounds?
We can.
Okay.
Just as a little point of information, if people really want to know more of the compounds, there are other laboratory techniques that are really specialized that they can send samples off to do. There's a time of flight method, and there's some other high definition mass spec methods that are capable of resolving more compounds. But this gets very expensive and very time consuming.
Sure. Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the precursor compounds and if you guys have any capabilities to analyze for the precursors?
Yeah, I mean, basically, so when you think of precursors, that implies that there's something to be a precursor of. And there are really two compounds that people are concerned about from a health perspective. And those are known as PFOS and PFOA. Those are also known as C8 compounds, meaning they're eight carbon chains. So really, nobody's quite sure what all the precursors are, but if they're eight carbon chains or longer, they have potential to be precursors. And we do see some of those in the list of 24 that we're currently certified or getting certified for. But then there's another technique which is specifically designed to get at the total mass load of these potential precursors. And that technique, not surprisingly, is called total oxidizable precursor assay, or TOP assay. And basically what you do is you run a sample like you normally would for the 24 compounds, and then you take a split of that sample and you subject it to a very rigorous oxidation step using persulfate, kept very basic and heated for 6 hours. And then you take that and you run it again and see how much the PFOS and PFOA load has increased as a result of that oxidation step. So we can see some of the precursors, and then we have a technique to see, what the total load of the precursors is in the sample.
So Mike, can you talk about your certifications for the lab? I mean, I think there may be some folks out there that are doubtful that a mobile laboratory could even obtain certifications.
Sure. Yeah, we'll do. The mobile laboratory certification process has been in play. We've been certified for with the NELAP program and the DOD or the ELAP program since 2004. I think we were one of, I think probably the first generation of mobile labs being certified. But more recently, with this PFAS laboratory, we are pursuing the ELAP certification, which will allow us to work on the federal sites, the Air Force, Navy, Army sites. But the idea of the process is to do the method validation, get one PT under your belt and a successful PT, hopefully, and then you invite a third party validation team to come in, and they basically represent the DOD and make sure that we are doing all of our analytical procedures as per the DOD quality system manual. So there's a 2 to 3 day audit that we just went through last week, We were very successful at that. We had all of our parameters under control, and we were able to demonstrate all the validation parameters. But the next steps are for us to follow through on the next PT. You need two PTs to become accredited, and really we're hoping in about a month we will have our ELAP or DoD certification for the laboratory.
That's great.
And so as Mike mentioned, we'll have the ELAP accreditation, which is Department of Defense, within about a month. And then we will get primary accreditation from NELAP, which is the civilian side, same sort of program. And we get primary accreditation in one state. Typically, we seek that in either New Jersey or New York. And then we can get secondary accreditations in other states where we work. So, you know, within the next few months, we will have both the military and the civilian side covered in terms of accreditations.
Well, that's great, guys. I think we got a lot of information out of that. And is there anything you wanna add before we close this out?
Yeah, give us a call. We'd love to come to your site and analyze your samples.
Excellent.
Walking over through the parking lot to the new Cascade Technical Services PFAS Mobile Lab. And this is our latest,
not in here.
This is our latest development in bringing analytical chemistry to the field to help site investigators make better decisions and do things more cost effectively. So we're entering the lab right now. You can hear the nitrogen generator running in the background that produces nitrogen and very clean air for use in the analytical instrumentation. And here we are in the sample login area where samples will be brought in from the field and they'll be set here until the analyst can prep them. And then they will be brought over to the corner of the laboratory here where we have a Gerstel solid phase extraction robotic setup, and that system basically cleans up the samples and concentrates the samples prior to being injected in the analytical instrumentation, which is a liquid chromatograph with dual mass specs. We can do two types of sample introduction. We can do the solid phase extraction if the samples need to be cleaned up or concentrated, or we can directly inject water samples into the column, which is sometimes faster and easier. With these techniques, Mike Rossi is here with me. He's our director of analytical chemistry. So the throughputs with the two different techniques, the solid phase extraction versus the direct injection, what's the difference in terms of throughput during a day of operation?
Yeah, we're just finishing up some of the development of these methods, but we're thinking roughly 20 minutes to 30 minutes for the direct inject, and then about probably 20% longer than that for the SBE because there's some extra steps involved with the SBE. The other thing we're considering, as well as a kind of an abbreviated list, because our standard list is looking at about 24 or so compounds, which matches to what the DoD is putting forth as the important compounds. However, there's a lot of private sites, non-AFFF sites, that you're only looking for the PFOS, PFOA compounds. And that said, you don't need the full analyte list, obviously, and we could streamline the analytical method and the runtime, for that matter, and produce results closer to probably 15 minutes for a turnaround, and with reporting it's closer to 20 minutes to a half hour, but still much faster, much higher throughput if we're just looking for the limited list of compounds on the private sites.
Good point. And we've also been considering that when we go to AFFF sites, which are more complicated analyte lists, we can get ourselves into the plume cores using that abbreviated analyte list much more quickly and efficiently. And then we'd still have enough sample volume to run the full analyte list. So with the very same sample, we can do reconnaissance with a high degree of quality, and we can do the full analyte list at the same time.
So a mobile lab like this, you've done this before for other contaminants.
Yeah, we've been fielding mobile laboratories since 1995. We started out pretty simple, doing just gas chromatography with flame ionization detectors for chlorinated solvents. Then we graduated to GC mass spec for volatile organics. Now we have a specialty technique where we extract contaminant mass from the rock matrix at fractured rock contaminated sites. And we analyze those on a GCMS or a GC-ECD. We have a PCB method, and we are in the process of developing an EPA method 8270 for semi-volatile organic compounds. So we have a lot of experience in both analytical chemistry, but more importantly, bringing that analytical chemistry to the field, where it really does the most good for site investigators.
So how far does this mobile lab go? It's in Vermont now, so where can it go?
Well, it can go pretty much anywhere someone wants it. I mean, it's in a trailer on wheels, so we can take it anywhere in North America that way. Mike and I have been doing this for a long time, as I mentioned, and we've brought laboratories to Puerto Rico, Switzerland, Scotland, England, France. In fact, Mike's going to France this spring with a mobile laboratory. We set up a laboratory in South Africa for a long time. So, you know, we can go pretty much anywhere. This instrumentation in the PFAS lab is a little bigger, heavier, and more sophisticated, so I think we'll probably limit its trips to the continental part of North America.
How big is the trailer?
That's a good question. 25
feet.
What is it?
25 feet
25
long.
25 feet long.
25 by 8, more or less?
25 by 9, I believe. Yep.
With plenty of headroom.
Lots of headroom, lots of air conditioning and heating, so it's pretty mobile, and climate control is an important part of it.
Yeah, and as we heard on the way in, we generate our own nitrogen and zero-grade air. There's an onboard generator, so it can power itself. It's got its own water supply, so it's pretty self-sufficient.
Any closing statements about the mobile lab?
It's awesome. Give us a try.
All right, on behalf of Rob Dinkert, this is Sue Bruning. I'd like to thank our audience for listening, making it through our very first podcast. Don't forget to check out our website at cascade-env.com and follow us on all the cool social channels, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Google+, and Instagram. And a special thank you today to our producer, Melissa Wells.
What are we going to talk about during our next show?
Well, I believe we have IDW, which is another great acronym for the industry, Investigation-Derived Waste. Do you know what that is, Rob?
The waste that's generated from typically site drilling activities or remediation or any sort of byproduct of the work that we do. Is that right?
Yeah, and sometimes it's a regulated hazardous waste and sometimes it's not. Just depends on what's in it. But a lot of times it's kind of an afterthought when you're dealing with a big drilling project or a big remediation project. So we'll talk a little bit about what it is and how you can manage it properly.
Okay, that sounds great.
Well, thank you for listening to Dig Deep, a podcast sponsored by Cascade Environmental, here to educate and entertain our listening audience.
Thank you for listening to Dig Deep, brought to you by Cascade Environmental. For more information about Cascade, go to cascade-env.com.